The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The most interesting tell going forward, if Trump loses in November, is going to be the way in which he views his sort of getting out of presidency sale. You know, does he look at the last 3 months of his administration as the opportunity to really go whole hog on emoluments? And it would strike me that that's really the danger. The danger isn't so much the national security threat right now. The danger is the national security threat once he knows he's going to be leaving. Because then he won't care. It doesn't matter if he violates the Constitution. It doesn't matter if he commits impeachable offenses. A, he's committed impeachable offenses before. And B, if he does during the lame duck session, so what? He's out, on January 20th, 2021 anyway.
I'm Susan Hennessy, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 30th, 2020. On Sunday, September 27th, the New York Times dropped bombshell new reporting on nearly two decades of Donald Trump's tax return data. The story has attracted enormous attention and paints a dismal picture. Donald Trump paid no personal income taxes for 11 of the past 18 years. He uses tax deductions aggressively, and last year he paid a whopping $750 in federal income tax. But there's much more to the story. So is this a story of a president merely in massive debt, or is there something more sinister at play? Who exactly does the president owe all this money to? What are the national security risks of the president being in this sort of financial position? So to answer these questions, we brought in a panel of experts to try and break it down. I sat down with Margaret Taylor, a fellow at Brookings and senior editor at Lawfare, Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and the author of The Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency, and Adam Davidson, a contributing writer to The New Yorker who has written extensively on Trump's financial entanglements. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 30th, Trump's Money and National Security. So, Margaret, I want to sort of start with you to just set the scene. Since 2016 and even before, everybody has been sort of clamoring for Donald Trump's tax returns. The New York Times finally got them. What do they say? What do we know now that's new? Kind of get us up to speed on where we're at.
Thanks, Susan. I'm thinking lots of our listeners will probably be pretty familiar with the contours of the New York Times article itself, because it has been such blockbuster news since the New York Times published it on Sunday evening. But it's interesting because there are still a fair number of mysteries, I'd say, and unanswered questions that I'm sure we will get into. But the basics are, you know, for years, Trump has refused to make his tax returns public, despite lots of pressure during the 2016 campaign. That broke a norm that's been respected since the post-Watergate era. He said that it was because he was under audit. He offered various explanations, which didn't really hold water. That upped the interest in getting these tax returns. And various congressional committees have made various requests to, you know, private entities like Mazars, which is Trump's accounting firm, as well as to the IRS and Treasury. And those cases have been working their way through the courts and very slowly, with really no resolution on the merits in sight. So this New York Times article really, really kind of drops a lot of information into that setting. The New York Times makes clear that they reviewed over 20 years of Trump's tax returns. And just the big takeaways laid out in the article are, you know, as you said, Trump paid no taxes at all for 10 of the previous 15 years. largely because he reported losing much more money than he made. In essence, a lot of his businesses are big money losers. In 2016 and 2017, he paid exactly $750, which is an extremely low amount. In addition, the article makes clear there's been a 10-year audit battle going on with the Internal Revenue Service over, in particular, a $73 million tax refund that Trump claimed and received, actually received that money after declaring huge losses. The reporting also shows the use of questionable accounting practices, including some potentially involving his adult children, specifically Ivanka Trump. And they also show that the president owes about $420 million personally, him personally, in loans that are coming due over the next 4 years or so. So those are the big takeaways.
So Adam, I have a million questions for you on this, but I want to start with one sort of mystery that Margaret, I think, kind of alluded to. And that's sort of the question about this debt. So yesterday, Nancy Pelosi kind of came out swinging. She gave an interview. She said the president appears to have over $400 million in debt. To whom? Different countries? What is the leverage they have? So for me, this is a national security question. So as someone who reports on these really complicated financial questions, sort of walk us through the evidence on that point. Do we actually have answers about who Trump owes money to? Is there evidence that this debt actually is held by foreign governments or foreign interests, or is that an overread?
So yeah, we can walk through some of it, and there's a lot we know. Well, no, there's a lot we don't know, and a tiny bit we do know. So we do know that, you know, there's this rapid increase in debt starting around 2011. This is right around when, for example, Deutsche Bank shifted him from Deutsche Bank's own balance sheet, meaning sort of taking a Deutsche Bank corporate risk on Trump, to their private banking, meaning we believe that some other rich customer of Deutsche Bank or some group of them was using Deutsche Bank to lend money to Trump. Now, that can be a legitimate, totally reasonable thing, or that can be a very easy channel of money laundering, bribing, whatever you want. And I think the reason you hear so much about Deutsche Bank is, you know, they're widely seen as one of the most aggressive, least bound by.
That's a polite term for sketchy, Adam.
Yeah, sketchy. They are super, super, super sketchy. And so it is a major black box that we know at least $125 million for Doral and other huge payments went through, and we just know literally nothing. That could be Vladimir Putin himself, or that could be the Archdiocese of Cleveland. We have no idea who that was. And so that alone should be disturbing, that the sketchiest bank in the world, or one of them, is processing a loan. Deutsche Bank is known particularly for taking advantage of the massive capital flight out of Russia and the former Soviet Union. Although, to be fair, so did every major bank, or so does every major bank. We should make that present tense. The other thing is, in this period when Trump is going into profound debt, he's making some very disturbing friendships. He's making business relationships with the Mamata family in Azerbaijan, the Aguilera family, formerly of Azerbaijan, now in Russia, with a group of people in Georgia and Kazakhstan, who I've written about, with Hari Tenasebjo in Indonesia, an extremely troubling kind of Trump-Putin-esque figure who's trying to marry business excess and political influence with people very close to the regime in the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he's doing deal after deal with some very, very sketchy people who are proven to be people willing to, you know, launder money, capital flight, bribery, et cetera, et cetera. So we see his debt growing way beyond what it's ever been at exactly the time that the legitimate sources we know of, his father, which is not, it's partially legitimate and clearly partially part, probably part of a tax fraud, Mark Burnett and NBC, and just basic banking are drying up. And the world he's swimming in is just as sketchy a stew as you can imagine. So it's very hard to think that there are, you know, legitimate sources that would have been giving him hundreds of millions in debt. It's hard to think who those would be.
So, Dan, yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, you authored an article entitled "Are Trump's Personal Debts a National Security Threat?" And I eagerly clicked on it, like, yes, give him hell, Dresner. He's going to explain exactly why this is this egregious national security risk, totally intolerable, which was my first reaction. And I was pretty surprised to read that you think it's actually a closer question. And really, you sort of lay out the argument for why maybe a president who's $421 million in debt isn't quite the outrageous, egregious national security risk that it appeared, at least to people like me, on first read.
Right. So I should say two things at the outset. The first is, I'm not saying he's not a national security threat, and I didn't try to say that in the column, because there is a way in which this could represent a national security threat. But I think what happened is everyone read the Times piece, and the Times piece, you know, quickly gave off two, you know, clear facts. The first is, as you say, he owes, you know, more than $400 million in the next couple of years, which, very importantly, he is personally pledged to repay. So it's not just the Trump organization. He himself has staked that, which, you know, he said very famously was a big mistake that he did in the early 90s. And yet it would seem that he has now put himself in that exact same position. The second salient fact is that most of his businesses, by the tax forms, look like they are losing money. You know, if you read through the Times story, it becomes clear that basically the only thing that is really earning him revenue is the first Trump Tower that he owns in Manhattan, and essentially the proceeds from The Apprentice. You know, those are significant revenue streams. He gets minor revenue streams from his branding deals overseas and so forth, but nothing that would cover the $400 million that he owes. So, as you know, many have suggested, this, you know, this could be a problem if he owes foreign creditors, as Adam is, you know, correctly potentially inferred. This would potentially be an instance in which, you know, he could be vulnerable to coercive pressure. And as several national security professionals said in reaction to this story, you know, high levels of debt, ordinarily, if you want a national security clearance, having high levels of debt is considered a security risk. The reason why I think this is somewhat overstated in Trump's case, there are several. The first is, and I think this was best pointed out by Josh Barrow in a column he wrote for New York, is that the tax forms in some ways overestimate how unprofitable his businesses are. And partly what's going on here is that the reason the businesses look unprofitable is that what Trump has excelled at doing is essentially basically converting what every other household would consider ordinary daily expenses into business expenses for him. So, for example, I think the most amusing example of this is that he charged, what, north of $70,000 in hair styling while he was on The Apprentice as a business deduction. And so that represented a potential loss for him. And similarly, you know, we see that with respect to his clubs and so on and so forth. So, you know, if there was more conventional accounting, my suspicion is that some of his businesses would be turning more of a profit. But there are two bigger reasons why I'm skeptical that this is really a national security threat. The first is the question of Trump's ability to repay isn't just a function of how much income he has coming in. It's what are the value of the assets that he holds. And he clearly holds assets that are well in excess of $400 million. He will be able to repay, you know, his creditors and still, you know, be on the Forbes billionaire list. Because despite the impression that the Times story left, which is the properties like the Doral or what have you aren't profitable, he could probably sell them for quite a significant haul. And therefore, if he absolutely had to pay his creditors, he could do so. And it wouldn't really be that hard for him to do. The second reason that I think it's exaggerated is that if there is one skill that Donald Trump has excelled at in business over the last three decades, it is in screwing over his creditors, which is to say that Trump knows that you know, if you owe the bank $1 million, that's your problem. But if you owe the bank $400 million, that's the bank's problem. And so what I think that he has probably calculated is that, you know, even if he does have difficulties in repaying, in all likelihood, his creditors will probably not try to just seize the assets, but rather try to enable him to earn more money as a way of, you know, collecting their payment. And so I think the problem with this isn't a problem. The Times reporting was accurate, but I think it left a misleading perception that he would have no ability to repay such massive debts. And I think he clearly does have the ability to repay those debts. And so I think he probably isn't necessarily vulnerable to foreign pressure, or as vulnerable as the Time story initially suggested.
So I don't disagree with anything Dan just said, but I still think that his finances make him an enormous national security threat. So I just want to make sure I get to make that case. So I agree that him owing someone money is not, I don't know that he's capable of taking in, you know, we could do pop psychology, the idea that he owes someone money in any real way. The two things I would most want to know is, what is the story he's telling himself about the future? And so what is the story he's telling himself about how he's going to maintain glory and wealth and power going forward? Even if he wins re-election, what would that be? And certainly if he doesn't. And I would suspect there are many people whispering in his ears. We know for a fact that several different intelligence services have sort of made it a point of picking off people close to him, and presumably him as well, with, you know, exciting lucrative opportunities. We know from before he was president that he's very comfortable doing business with people who are not friends of the United States. And there's no reason to think, you know, I think he defines friends of the United States as anyone who will do business with him. So I would be less backward looking and more forward looking, first of all. But second of all, I do think, like, we as a country, and certainly Bob Mueller as an investigator, have misunderstood how compromise works as a just essential day-to-day tool of the former Soviet Union and other countries. That compromise is not, it's not necessarily PP tapes in a hotel, and it's not the president of the country brings out a manila folder and says, ha, look what I have on you. It is embedded into every transaction in highly corrupt nations. It's just an understood part of the environment in which there's, you know, very, very clear ways of communicating to people their vulnerabilities. And, you know, the deals that I've written about, the Azerbaijan deal, that's almost certainly a money laundering front for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the deal in Georgia that's closely connected to the biggest bank fraud money laundering case in history that leads straight to people close to Putin. We don't know what documents there are, what photos there are, what information there is, and we don't know that about so many other deals. So those are the things. I agree with Dan that this is a man impervious to shame, that things that most of us would see as utterly devastating and we would do everything we have to not let them come out or not, that doesn't apply here. And so looking forward is more important. But that being said, he's really got it. I mean, it is amazing, astounding, the kind of legal risks he has taken in the last decade. And I would want to know more about that.
There's another aspect of the article, which was, you know, showing how big the losses have been on his properties points up another national security risk, which commentators and lots of outside groups have identified all along, which is the potential for foreign governments to come in and, for example, you know, rent hundreds of rooms at the Trump International Hotel and have Trump know that and have that be something that, you know, is sort of offered to him. So I think one thing that this article does show is it shows those how necessary and how sort of desperate a lot of these businesses are, thereby showing the, you know, the real risks associated with not only foreign governments, frankly, but anybody seeking to curry favor with the president can come in and go ahead and give him a bunch of business in these various locations.
Yeah, so one line of sort of criticism of the Times approach to sort of reporting this story out has been that, yeah, you know, it tells a story of a president who is in a lot of debt, and it tells a story of a president that's broke, but it sort of accepts the tax returns or the information in it on their face. And should they, right? Is this actually a story about tax avoidance? Is it a story about, even more sort of sinister, illegitimate financial practices. And so, Adam, I was struck by sort of a long thread you tweeted out earlier about money laundering and about the Trump's property in Aberdeen in particular. So sort of to you, but also kind of to the larger group, you know, do we accept the premise that this is just a story of, you know, a president who has accurately reported his financial dealings on his taxes, and we can sort of accept that premise and go from there? Or should we challenge that sort of that presumption and say, wait a minute, actually, maybe this isn't a story of sort of national security risks in a general sense. Maybe this is a story about financial crime. Am I Trump deranged? Am I going too far?
Well, they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, I made me think of when I was a reporter in Baghdad when the U.S. for the first year of the U.S. occupation, and I remember interviewing the head of the Iraqi Auditors Association, and he's talking about their work, and I said, "So you make sure all the books that you audit are accurate?" He goes, "No. We know for sure every book is inaccurate, but we make sure the numbers add up correctly." And I think of that in terms of any financial document that the Trump Organization releases. And you know, we can see this. I mean, one of my favorite documents, an essential read, is Alan Weisselberg's testimony in the foundation, the Trump Foundation case before, you know, to the New York Attorney General, because he pretty much lays out how the accounting system works, how the internal accounting system works. And it's literally a small number of people just make stuff up. So yes, we know for sure the tax returns are inaccurate, I would say. I mean, it would be the most remarkable outcome if it turned out they were accurate. The problem with inaccuracies, you know, this is something auditors and accountants will tell you. If an account is off by 13 cents, you could say, oh, that's a trivial number. Or you could say, all we know is it's wrong. It could be off by millions, and it's just the 13 cents is the thing that reveals it. So it is a kind of confounding thing that, like, sort of the Trump theories are somehow that he's both broke and an international business mastermind who has sold his soul. I'm of the view, personally, that he's broke in this sense. I think Dan is right. He has assets that, if he had to liquidate, could cover his debts. But, you know, if you define broke as, do you have enough liquid cash coming in on a regular basis to cover the life you want? He clearly doesn't. I mean, he clearly has had many periods that we know about where he's been incredibly cash strapped, desperate for quick cash. He's made very weird decisions to get a few hundred thousand or a couple million, which maybe for most of us is a lot of money, but not for somebody who does have the assets that he has. So I think it is a mix of both things. He does have a huge range of ways of bringing money in from very sketchy people around the world. In a sense, you could even call it creative. At the same time, he is in a near constant state of feeling afraid that he's not going to be able to keep the lights on. Now, for some reason, I've spent half the day tweeting responses to people who don't understand money laundering. And to me, it's a simple thing. But lying on your taxes, money laundering, all of these things are variants of the same thing. You figure out a way to make books that tell one story that seems like a okay story, and you're really doing something else with your money. It's a form of financial storytelling. And it doesn't have to be very sophisticated. This is stuff that very crude people do. And I don't think the Trump Organization is particularly sophisticated. But that's why I do think you want to look at his behavior more than in addition to the numbers. The numbers are helpful because even lies are helpful. Even things we know are untrue. Why did he tell that lie? Why did he make that point? And that's often very telling. And when he does, as he often does, tell different stories to different audiences, you can start to at least asymptotically, hopefully, approach the truth. But you also have to look at his behavior. And this is the behavior of a desperate man who will take enormous risks for very little gain.
I just wanted to piggyback on Adam there, because I do think this is definitely an area where I agree with him. And it's the one thing that gives me pause. And it's funny that Adam mentioned 13 cents, because reading the Times story, what I kept going back to was that infamous Spy magazine story back in 1990, when Spy magazine basically sent out checks, I think equivalent to $1.11, to 50 of the so-called the wealthiest people in New York, of whom half cashed them. So then they sent out checks to them of like 50 something cents. And again, 26 people cashed those. Then they sent out checks of 13 cents to people, you know, just sort of from some corporation, you know, claiming it was a refund or whatever. And only two people cashed the checks of 13 cents. One was Adnan Khashoggi, who was a Saudi arms dealer. The other was Donald Trump. And the point being that I agree with Adam, that even though Trump probably has the ability to repay a lot of his debts, he does act like someone who is absolutely desperate for cash and is willing to debase himself in any number of ways, you know, to earn what seems like, compared to his net wealth, marginal sums of money. And so really the question becomes, what is Donald Trump's mindset about all this? That even if he does have the ability to either delay his creditors and or pay back his creditors, if he feels like his way of life is threatened, then yes, that does leave him vulnerable to pressure. And so I guess what I was trying to say in the column was, I don't think that actually, if you look at the fundamental numbers, Trump is necessarily vulnerable, that he could repay and that's not really that big of a deal. But what matters is, what does Donald Trump think about his finances? And he acts like a desperate man in that instance. And so there I do agree with Adam. He might very well be, it might well be a national security vulnerability.
So I want to sort of zoom out and get into this larger story of, you know, what is the story of Trump's financials and its intersection with foreign policy and national security. But before we sort of leave the specific tax return story, I want to sort of briefly go around. We're now about 48 hours after a major story has broke. You know, Margaret, sort of starting with you, what has the kind of initial wave of coverage gotten wrong or missed? You know, do you think by and large sort of the public is, you know, understanding and adjusting a really, really complicated story? Or are there features that you think, you know, people really are missing this or that they really should be focused on?
Well, largely, this is happening in the context of a huge political fight right now. And so, you know, I cover Congress, of course, I worked on Capitol Hill. And what I've been watching pretty closely is to see the reactions of Democrats, of course, and you've talked about Nancy Pelosi, seeing the reactions of Republicans, seeing how the messaging on this story gets created and pushed out. And it's, to me, it's been quite interesting because the main political story, it seems, is this idea that despite being a billionaire, Donald Trump only paid $750 in taxes in 2016 and 2017. From a political perspective, that's pretty powerful because you can compare that amount to, you know, a single school teacher who paid $7,000 in taxes. So it's interesting to see how the political actors in our system have definitely gravitated toward sort of one aspect of this story. I actually think what are the questions coming down the pike is not being covered as well, I'd say, as those the political side of that. As I said in the opener, I do think there are just a lot of questions still hanging out there about what all of this means, what other avenues are there? Is there a money laundering component? And one thing that makes things a little bit difficult is that the New York Times is not actually releasing the tax returns. It is keeping close the actual documents and the sourcing on it. And I will just say, up on Capitol Hill, Kevin Brady, who's a congressman from Texas, Republican, the ranking member on House Ways and Means, basically, you know, called for a probe into the sources of the New York Times story, saying that a felony crime may have been committed by someone giving Trump's tax information to the newspaper. So, you know, there's different ways that Republicans, at least on Capitol, are sort of running with this thing. Another reaction from Chuck Grassley, a Republican on Senate Finance, was essentially to say, gee, why is it taking the IRS so long to get this audit done, which is a sort of fascinating response to this. So one thing, I've been watching the reactions on Capitol Hill, and it's been not very uniform, and people are definitely sort of grasping at what comes next.
So Dan or Adam, before we sort of talk about the larger picture, do either of you sort of have your one point that you think everybody's missing that's being overlooked in the story?
I think Adam should go after me because he knows Trump's finances better. I mean, in some ways, the original story had a lot of complexities, but the lead was, as Margaret says, the $750. And so that's sort of how what everyone is focused on. It strikes me that the one takeaway that might not be getting headlines is two. One is that it seems like the IRS has the upper hand in terms of this audit, that Trump really did violate the law in terms of the deduction that he made on walking away from, I believe it was the Atlantic City casino. But if I understand the law correctly, you can only do that legally if you don't get anything of value from walking away from it. And he clearly got a 5% stake in the reconstituted property. That seems pretty cut and dried to me. So in the end, his tax obligations are going to go up. The other thing that I keep thinking is that if I'm Trump, what is frightening about this is not so much the payments that'll come due in terms of his debts, but rather whether or not this leaves him vulnerable to criminal prosecution if he doesn't get reelected. Because it does seem like this, you know, there's tax avoidance and then there is tax fraud. And we know from a previous Times story that the Trump family has committed tax fraud. This seems to suggest that there is probably more tax fraud going on.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. So I'm tempted to say a couple things. I mean, one thing, which maybe not in the few weeks before an election, but part of what's so upsetting is just how different the world of taxation is when you are a rich person than a poor person. So that is, let's put that to one side for today's conversation. But some of what's most shocking is the stuff he did that's not only not illegal, but is completely normal. So let's put that aside. To me, And the Times, this is, and I tweeted like crazy about this today, this is the one quibble I really had with the piece. There's a very clear story that goes from the previous Times tax story to this one, which is that what Trump's basically done throughout his career is he has a source of money that's, for whatever reason, sort of just pouring money on him without checking that he spends it properly. It was his dad. It was a surprising number of New York banks for a while. And then it was Mark Burnett and The Apprentice. And in 2009-10, all of that dries up. But he then, starting in 2011, goes on the biggest spending spree of his career. And his claim is, it was all my money. And the Times reports that as if that's just true. They actually say it could be his earnings from The Apprentice, it could be cash flow. When you do the math, it is possible, or I think it's just about possible, but it feels hard to reconcile that with other things that are going on in his life. Why he's spending hundreds of millions, tens of millions of dollars on these money-losing golf courses while desperately doing gigs to get $500,000 here, $1 million there. It is a little confusing how that's happening. So I feel there's evidence to suggest it is worth asking, was he spending other people's money? And that would certainly be a much more consistent story with the story of his entire business career. There's some suggestion he was, you know, Eric Trump saying, you know, we have these Russian golf fanatics who give us hundreds of millions of dollars. Trump doing business with two Russian golf fanatics, the Mamatovs and the Agalarovs, who were also laundering money through golf at the same time Trump was investing in golf. I think there's nothing will be definitively proven until someone with subpoena power actually investigates, but a lot of suggestions. So to me, that's really my takeaway. What happened in 2011 that he both started spending more money than ever before, but had no obvious source of new money?
So sort of whatever the nature of the sort of debts in question and his pre-presidential financial and personal life, I do think that one thing that the sort of taxes pretty plainly show is that despite Trump's sort of pledge of no new foreign deals, he clearly continues to have significant foreign entanglements and makes enough money in foreign countries to need to pay substantial taxes there. You know, not to be like the old fuddy-duddy, but the framers of the Constitution actually were sort of worried about exactly this thing, right? The idea that a president is supposed to take a salary, a president isn't supposed to accept emoluments, because you didn't want the perception or reality of these foreign financial interests influencing actual policy decisions. So, you know, Dan, you've been, you know, sort of looking at Trump's foreign policy. You just wrote this excellent book, which I commend to any and all Lawfare podcast listeners about Trump as a toddler. Toddlers are self-dealing and in it for themselves. But as you tell the story of Trump's foreign policy over the last 3 years, do you look at it and say, yeah, the story of Trump's foreign policy on Turkey is financial enrichment and him being influenced by his own business interests? That's the story in the Philippines. Or is that just, you know, kind of the deranged left and people who are just inherently suspicious of who Trump is? And actually the evidence of how he's made foreign policy decisions while in office are, you know, there's not this really tight nexus to, yeah, well, you know, he did this and that clearly was to give X, Y, or Z country a break.
Yeah, the problem here is that you can spin two different narratives, and depending upon what you think, they're both reasonably compelling. You know, narrative one says he's in this for the money, that, and therefore, if you look at his dealings with Turkey or the Philippines or perhaps India, and I think Brazil, and the Times story does recount this, that there are clear examples where these governments have put people in political power that had prior business dealings with Trump as a way to cater to his whim. And that perhaps, and you know, I think the most obvious example of this is in Turkey, where Erdogan's government, you know, when they were negotiating with the Trump administration, you know, made sure to invest in hundreds of thousands of dollars in Trump hotel, you know, in the Trump DC hotel. Then when the relationship briefly hit a rocky patch, they canceled all of it, and then they rejuvenated it. So, you know, it would be easy to look at those and assume that there are emoluments, that there are essentially quid pro quos. The problem with this, though, is that there is another equally plausible story, which is that Donald Trump has an authoritarian mindset and just really likes other autocrats. That, and you know, this is consistent long before Trump became president, during the campaign, where, you know, Trump clearly admires people like Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un or Xi Jinping or so forth, and wishes in some ways that he had similar powers. And so as a result, you know, Trump's record on human rights has largely been laughable, because in no small part, he feels like the world is a nasty place, and therefore he should be able to do business on behalf of the United States with all of these different autocracies. And the problem is both of these stories are equally plausible, and they're not mutually exclusive. It might be that both are going on. I think in some ways the most interesting thing that would be the most interesting tell going forward if Trump loses in November is going to be the way in which he views his sort of getting out of presidency sale. You know, does he look at the last 3 months of his administration as the opportunity to really go whole hog on emoluments? And it would strike me that that's really the danger. The danger isn't so much the national security threat right now. The danger is the national security threat once he knows he's going to be leaving, because then he won't care. It doesn't matter if he violates the Constitution. It doesn't matter if he commits impeachable offenses. A, he's committed impeachable offenses before. And B, if he does during the lame duck session, so what? He's out, you know, on January 20th, 2021 anyway. And he clearly is, you know, someone who's demonstrated zero shame up till now. So as I said in the piece, it would not surprise me if he sort of looks at the federal government the same way Rod Blagojevich looked at Obama's Senate seat when Obama won the presidency, that this was a chit that he could cash in.
So, Margaret, it strikes me that there is a body that is supposed to, I don't know, oversee and adjudicate exactly the kind of questions of improper and mixed motives in executive decision making, and that's Congress. Adam mentioned subpoena power earlier. You know, you worked on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Where is Congress on this, right? Sort of this has been a feature of the Trump presidency from the earliest days. We're almost to the end of his first term. What is Congress doing? Are they sort of twiddling their thumbs? Are they engaging in some kind of meaningful oversight that just hasn't sort of come to fruition? Kind of what is the story of congressional oversight in this space?
Well, as I alluded to in my opening remarks, you know, the tax returns have been of great interest to, in particular, House Democrats, and they have explored different ways to get them without success. So, and there's two different lawsuits. We've done a lot on the podcast about those, in particular the Mazars suit. But I will just specifically talk a little bit about, you know, Richard Neal. He is the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's, you know, has been after these tax returns for some time. In 2019, he sent a request to the IRS and Treasury for the tax returns. They basically said no. Then he issued a subpoena for them. Secretary Mnuchin refused. And then the committee went to court. And so then the question is, okay, well, what happened to the case? That suit was brought in July of 2019 to try to force the turnover of those tax returns. But the court, the case was stayed by the U.S. District Court Judge Trevor McFadden, and it essentially the judge said, we're going to wait for the proceedings in the McGann case, which is seemingly unrelated, but actually poses similar legal questions about a committee's standing and sort of cause of action in court. So that case was actually stayed in mid-August when it looked like there was going to be some movement in the McGann case. The committee asked the judge to lift it, but later withdrew it because of all of the machinations in the McGann case. And so in some ways, it shows this just utter sort of inability of the committee to vindicate its interests through the courts. And so my answer is, it's not that Congress has been, at least House Democrats, they've not been twiddling their thumbs, but they have been looking to the courts to try to get this information. I will just say also, one of the interesting parts of the New York Times article is this question about the audit, which I alluded to earlier. And here we have a different sort of strange little committee in Congress called the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is an unusual committee. It's a nonpartisan committee. It's made up of House and Senate members, which is very unusual. Full disclosure, I did work with the Joint Committee on Taxation when I was up on the Hill on a totally different kind of matter, international double taxation treaties. But the role that they are playing here is actually quite interesting. And it's interesting from a separation of powers perspective as well. In particular, this committee has statutory power to review any refunds going to Americans that are over $2 million. And there are, you know, various staff members on this committee that review these things. And what this New York Times article really pointed out, which was new to me, was that Trump has been in the middle of this dispute with the IRS over a 2010 claim of about $73 million, which was money that he claimed or, you know, requested a refund for because he had paid some taxes. And due to some changes in the law, he was able to sort of, okay, well, I paid those taxes before. Now I have losses. Now I'm going to request this tax refund. And what it was something that they call a quickie refund, which means that actually, the refund was paid out within about 90 days back in 2010 on a tentative basis, and it's sort of pending an audit by the IRS. But nonetheless, the money was paid out to Trump, something like $73 million. But the audit then happened. And then as part of that process, the audit ended up going to this Joint Committee on Taxation, which took a look, and there was some sort of a discussion and agreement on it. But then the audit back at the IRS expanded, and there was never any resolution of whether that payment to Donald Trump of something like $73 million was actually allowable. There's never been any final sort of decision from the IRS about that, which is a big question mark for me about sort of what is the status? Why haven't they made a decision? What are they waiting for? What has the Joint Committee on Taxation said about it? Is it a disagreement between the Joint Committee on Taxation and the IRS? That's one of these big mysteries that we kind of don't know about. And very, very interesting role, I think, played by this committee, which, by the way, was set up back in 1927 for the very purpose of making sure that the executive branch wasn't sort of processing corrupt payments to sort of cronies in the government. So it's interesting to see this role that the committee has been playing, and that it's seems to be completely unresolved and big question marks around it.
So Adam, if we waved a magic wand and vested the New Yorker with subpoena power, what are the documents that you would ask for, right? Whenever you sort of talk about the unanswered questions, like, what are the missing pieces? Do you have documents in mind that you think, you know, if I was the chair of a committee, I would want X, Y, and Z, and you have a laundry list, and journalists sort of focused on these financial questions are just waiting, kind of ticking off boxes of, you know, well, once we get form B12, then we'll know this answer and this answer. Or is it something, you know, sort of you don't expect to find in these documents because you don't think that they will accurately represent sort of the underlying reality, right? So what are you looking to get your hands on most?
So the thing I would want the most is Alan Weisselberg, Trump's longtime chief financial guy, and some truth serum. And just and to be honest, in the Trump Foundation case, he really threw Trump under the bus pretty quickly. So it might not take a lot. I mean, Alan Weisselberg may be more interested in Alan Weisselberg than in protecting Trump. So
that would make him so unusual as a Trump, you know.
Yes, no, I can't tell you how many people I've
that there'd be disloyalty there. I'm blown away. I'm sorry.
I've never dealt with a group that is quicker to, like, I'll say whatever I want, but anything in print has to be how I supported the boss. Michael Cohen, by the way, is someone I would have zero interest in talking to. I don't think he knew any of the inside stuff. I think he was kept at distance. He did the kind of embarrassing stuff. The truth is, though, I mean, there was an interesting story that someone very high up in the Trump organization told me that there was some big, this is pre-2011, when they were still pre-2008, they were still getting bank loans. And some big bank was going to give them some big loan. I can't remember the details and probably couldn't tell you if I could. But so the bank said, we need an independent law firm to look at all of Trump's obligations so that we know all of his outstanding obligations. And the firm spent, it was a big project. They spent a lot of time and they couldn't figure it out because Trump gets an idea in his head. He'll call to a lawyer down the hall. As I've heard, he'll call a lawyer who was hired to handle lawsuits and tell that guy to do a deal, and a lawyer who was hired to do deals, who's a real estate lawyer, and tell him to do some lawsuit. Or he'll just pick up the phone and call a law firm or call an accountant. And so the conclusion was that it is literally unknowable, the obligations of Donald Trump. He doesn't remember, and there's no person, including Alan Weisselberg, who knows the extent of it. So that is an important thing to keep in mind. But Alan Weisselberg probably knows more than anyone else, including Donald Trump. He almost certainly knows more than Trump himself knows. So that would be the single biggest piece. The next piece would be, my assumption is that there's a good chance that some of the kind of Delaware LLCs have bank accounts that are set up to take in money fairly easily. And that's a very hard veil to pierce, even with subpoena power, because it's hard to know exactly what you're asking for and exactly where to look for it. As I understand it, I've never been a federal investigator, but you really do need first the source and then you know what accounts to look for, et cetera. I did want to just quickly backtrack one step on another major national security issue, which is Trump's friends. The president of the United States, we know, is on the phone for hours every day with a group of people, Sean Hannity and maybe Tom Barrack and Howard Lorber and LaFrack. These are sharks. And sharks, many of whom are known to have foreign engagements. It would be almost irrational for the Mossad and Saudi intelligence and Emirati intelligence and Chinese intelligence not to spend millions of dollars trying to figure out how to influence these people, either overtly or covertly. And I just don't want to forget that as far as I think we believe, right, that a lot of Trump's major decisions come down to whatever it is, the five or a dozen cronies that he calls every day, and influencing them could be just such a coup for a foreign intelligence service.
So, Dan, you know, where do you see after Trump reforms going, right? So whenever we think about sort of the president in foreign policy, right, the president is the sole organ of international relations. And sort of as a legal matter, as a constitutional matter, like the guy gets to do almost whatever he wants, really. It is almost sort of a Trumpian vision of how he thinks the rest of the presidency should operate. Do you think that let's imagine that Donald Trump is defeated in November. Do we all look at each other and say, well, that was weird, and just kind of go back to business as usual? Or do you think that actually sort of the aberrations of this moment prompt real reform or even hemming in of sort of the president's foreign policy powers, State Department oversight? Or do you see this being a catalyst for actual change?
Yeah, I kind of do. I mean, I would say that, and I talked about this in the toddler in chief, which is what you need to do is childproof the presidency. What Trump has revealed is that, as it turns out, the guardrails checking the president's power were worn down over decades, in some cases voluntarily by Congress, which is so riven by partisanship that it's very difficult for them to execute effective oversight, by the courts, which have demonstrated remarkable due deference to the executive branch, particularly in foreign affairs, and to the bureaucracy, which president after president have learned over time how to work that, to work the bureaucracy in such a way to get them to do what they want. If Biden wins in November, and also I think you're going to presume if you have a Democratic majority in the Senate, even if it's a very small one, you are likely to see, you know, is it called H.R. 1, the Nancy Pelosi's reforms, you know, put forward, that likely is going to get passed. So that would, among other things, mandate, for example, that presidential candidates have to reveal their tax returns. And so that would be a potential deterrent for a future plutocrat thinking that they might try to run for president just for brand promotion. And there are other steps you can do. I think one would obviously be to, for example, improve the autonomy and make it harder and more costly to fire inspectors general across the executive branch. Another would be a reform of the Vacancies Act, because that's another area where Trump has clearly been willing to muck around. If you start talking about more substantive foreign policy moves, there I suspect the efforts by Congress to rein in the president will be more restricted. Just because, again, part of the reason the president has such power in these areas is because Congress willingly gave power to them. So when it comes to both the power to declare war and the power to set tariffs, you know, originally the Constitution gave those powers to Congress. Over time, Congress, recognizing that it could not execute those powers terribly effectively, decided that they were willing to delegate them to the executive. And I am dubious that Congress will institutionally decide they need to reclaim them. There might be areas where they nibble at the margin. So for example, I think even Republicans demonstrated a willingness to, for example, limit when the president can use, for example, the national security rationale to impose tariffs. Even someone like Chuck Grassley doesn't like that. And I would not stun me if there is some partial reform of IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which Trump has really used to the utmost in you know, on issues ranging from threatening to sanction Mexico if they didn't engage in immigration enforcement, to the use of IEPA in trying to arrange this TikTok deal or this TikTok takeover by Oracle. So I do think there are areas where there will be some nibbling, but I think in the sort of fundamental foreign policy powers, you're not going to see much because, among other things, as bad as Trump has been, the presumption will be that maybe that will be an aberration. But more importantly, it is not clear at all that Congress is capable of actually employing those powers effectively in any way whatsoever.
And I would just add that on September 23rd, House Democrats did introduce a bill called the Protecting Our Democracy Act, and it is specifically aimed at sort of these issues of reform of, you know, presidential abuses, restoring checks and balances, strengthening accountability and transparency, protecting elections, really aimed at the sort of sins of the Trump presidency. And as Dan alludes to, there is this section that talks about, you know, strengthening congressional oversight of presidential emergency declarations. So that's the only area where I can see maybe there being sort of an international sort of component to it. And I would also just add that one question that's hanging out there, Susan, is if Democrats do take the Senate, are they going to get rid of the filibuster? And if they do, I think we could very well see a big package of these robust reforms. If they do not, then I think it will be much more modest because Republicans are just traditionally, you know, sort of favor a very strong presidency, are not going to agree to a whole lot of the things that Democrats have proposed.
The one thing I would say that I tend to agree with Margaret, but there might be one reason why Republicans would go along with this, which is, again, in a world in which Biden is president, it would not shock me if Republicans think that they can, you know, exploit some of these reforms to weaken an incoming Biden administration.
That is true. That
and
is
it also true. Allows them to say, see, we're moving beyond Trump. We're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. So I'm a little more optimistic that they might actually pass them, although then might then, you know, weaponize whatever is in that package.
So I want to end by asking everybody to make a prediction.
What are you, mad? My God.
We've seen the Mueller report. We've seen not one, but two Woodward books. There are still so many questions that are really, really fundamental that are open. And I'm curious, everybody's predictions on how long it takes until we get the definitive account of the Trump presidency and really get the answers to these questions. Does he walk out the door and so many books are written that like we could fill 50 bookshelves and we really have the full accounting? Or, you know, is this like other transgressive presidencies where actually it takes a long time, in some cases decades, to really understand the full story of what occurred in the White House during the presidential administration?
So to me, the thing we don't know is what path has he paved. The thing that terrifies me is that he has opened a path for the smart Trump, the Trump who's a few notches, has a few more notches more restraint, who isn't a toddler, and who really uses the power of the presidency to enrich themselves, to really permanently destroy democracy, etc. I forget the name, the guy who came before Mussolini, who, you know, kind of had this, took over that village in Croatia, and it became this big cause celeb. But everyone saw it as a big joke, and then it very quickly led to Mussolini. You know, so that to me is the question. You know, I don't feel like I've been having this joke. I grew up in Manhattan. I feel like I've not learned anything fundamentally new about Donald Trump since like 1983. and I don't know that I'm that interested. I don't read these books. Yeah. I mean, I'll be curious about some of the deals and deal making. Obviously, I'll be curious. But for me, we don't know where this story ends. We don't know how we heal. And that's what I want to know.
I guess I have two thoughts. First of all, we don't have a shortage of Trump books as it stands. I mean, I'm a contributor to this genre, so I should apologize for that. But two things. The striking thing about Donald Trump is the number of former Trump administration officials who are not just willing to publish books, but publish books that are really incredibly critical of Donald Trump. You know, we got to go back. There was, I remember, like, when Bob Gates published his memoirs after leaving the Obama administration, it was considered genuinely scandalous that that memoir contained criticism of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and Barack Obama, because that was unprecedented. But compared to what we've seen now, that's nothing. You know, that was genteel. But that said, I guess maybe this is me being optimistic. I think we will eventually wind up knowing the whole story from Donald Trump, not from any book, but from a criminal prosecution.
So I think I am in agreement with what Adam said about how we kind of already know so much about Donald Trump. We know so much about how his White House has worked. There's, to me, there's really not a lot of mystery there. I do think there is a question, as Dan says, of whether, you know, there are things where there is a prosecutable case that will be brought. That's a big question mark. For me, though, how this story ends is really more of a question about what happens with the core Trump base and what Republicans sort of do with the core Trump base going forward when Trump is out of office, and what America does with the core Trump base, because they're there. They really like Donald Trump. Donald Trump will continue to be a personality and a figure. He may start his own Fox News equivalent that will draw his base to him. So the country will be dealing with the Trump base of voters for many, many years and decades to come. And so for me, the question is, how do we deal with that so segment of society that supported Trump and the segment of society that obviously just can't stand him and basically hates him and thinks he's been terrible and has ruined American democracy or is on the way there? To me, that's the more interesting question of how does this end?
One piggyback thought on what Margaret just said, which is on the political side of things, in some ways, the problem we have is that we still don't know how the Trump era politically ends. You know, there's been this narrative as long as he's been president of the idea that Trump has survived scandals that would have felled any other president, and that therefore this gives this sort of aura of invulnerability to him. And that's one version of the narrative. And also, if he gets reelected, you know, that narrative will get reinforced as someone who, you know, literally can't be killed politically. If, however, Trump loses in November and Republicans lose the Senate, it's going to be a very different narrative that you tell. That narrative will be Donald Trump got elected in 2016 with a minority of the popular vote, but had majorities in both houses of Congress, Republican majorities in both houses of Congress. Republicans controlled, you know, the majority of the gubernatorial seats, state legislatures, and so on and so forth. And then the story of the last 4 years has been one of a political debacle for Republicans, in which they have lost control of every major political institution, save perhaps the Supreme Court. And that politically is going to be, there will be people who will follow Donald Trump regardless, but I'm not sure how many members of the Republican Party that'll include, because it would be difficult then to view the Trump presidency as anything but politically an unmitigated disaster.
We will leave it at that. Adam Davidson, Dan Dresner, and Margaret Taylor, thanks so much for joining me.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Your audio engineer was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo, and your producer was Jen Pacha Howell. The music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare podcast and share us widely. And as always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.